Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are many dimensions to that war. We have an opportunity most weeknights to evaluate different aspects of it. We're going to drill down in some detail on one particularly, well, I think it's fair to say, sordid chapter in the war for the free world, in which our own government, it seems, may have been complicit in concealing from the American people a sad and very deadly event, and one that we've still gotten quite to the bottom of. But that's notwithstanding the best efforts of our guest for this full hour. His name is Jack Cashel. He is an independent writer and producer and has been, among other things, acclaimed for several books that he has written. But the one that we're anxious to visit with him about, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. Jack Cashel, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, Frank, thanks for having me on, and thanks to my friends at Judicial Watch for setting this up.
Well, I'm so glad they were able to help us reconnect. Jack, we probably, most of us, don't remember terribly vividly TWA 800. I mean, frankly, even the brand is so passé, you know. TWA is no more, of course. Just in the shortest of short forms, tell us about this ill-fated flight, when it happened, and specifically, as best you can, what did happen?
Right. Well, the flight left New York, JFK, for Paris on July 17th, 1996, about 8:19 p.m. on a perfectly clear, pleasant day. 12 minutes outside of JFK, heading east along the south shore of Long Island, and which this is right about sunset. So this is a beach community, and so there's hundreds, thousands of people out looking at the sky. And that will make a difference in the telling of the story. But in any case, at 8:31, the plane explodes in full view of literally thousands of people. And 230 people are killed. And, you know, what happens after that, for about 12 hours, the truth is being told. You know, they haven't, the officials haven't gotten a hold of the truth yet and wrestled it into a manageable narration. So we know people are saying, hey, we saw something come up off the surface. It zigzagged out. It hit the plane. It blew it up. You know, there is a video made. MSNBC wins the bidding war. It's a home video. This is before, you know, cameras had videos. And it was also before the internet was mature. There's only about 10% of the American people were online then, which made a big difference because they couldn't have gotten away with it 10 years later. And the video was made, and it showed just that. It showed a what appeared to be a missile coming up off the surface, you know, and there are people on a deck, and they're watching it. And they said, someone says, hey, look at a rocket. And they watch it, and it goes up, it arcs, it zigzags, and then it blows up the airplane. Military people were saying this online. One military helicopter pilot, it happened right in his face, he says it on TV. Within 12 hours, the video was gone, and the story was changed. And that was the last we would hear of a missile in any meaningful way. Until independent investigators began to get into the story several years later. So I have to tell you about the evolution of my own thought on this, is that when I first got involved in this, it was the year 2000, it was 4 years later, and when I happened to meet I live in Kansas City, which is the historic hub of TWA, so there are a lot of veterans there. And they had brought in a fellow named James Sanders to speak. Sanders had written a book in 1997 called The Downing of TWA Flight 800. He was an investigative reporter, and when I met him and I went to hear him speak, I couldn't believe all the people at TWA who believed him. You know, up to that point, I thought it was just some sort of conspiracy theory. This is 4 years after the fact, because that's the way the media portrayed it. By the way, in 1996, Bill Clinton was running for re-election. That's a fact that is essential to the telling of the story. So when I got to talking to Sanders and his wife, Elizabeth, both of whom were arrested and charged with conspiracy, and they were convicted. In fact, Jane was still on probation. I was making videos at the time in addition to writing books. And I said, have you ever made a video? And we started talking. And I said, you know, before I get involved in this, you know, as compelling as your testimony is here tonight, I have to be absolutely convinced you're right. I have to be absolutely convinced that missiles took down this airplane. So, you know, and there's by that time, a couple of mainstream books out about the incident, and they both, you know, towed the government line. One was by an AP reporter, another one from CNN. But then I went down and I spent 3 or 4 days with the Sanders in Florida. And what they had access to that had just been released were all 750 some of the FBI 302s in which they interviewed the eyewitnesses. This had all been suppressed. None of these witnesses had ever been allowed to testify at an NTSB hearing or in any other format. The New York Times interviewed of the 750, one person, and that person, the FBI gave them early an investigation because they were at that time steering the New York Times to a bomb. And then I started reading these 302s, and they're one after another saying exactly the same thing.
So these were eyewitnesses who saw a missile shooting down an airplane, telling it to the FBI, Jack Cashel. And the FBI was essentially deep-sixing these 302s, these accounts of the evidence they were accumulating?
This is something I would find out later, Frank, is that, in fact, I only found out about 3 years ago, but I had enough time to include it in my book, which came out in 2016. This is thanks to the research of a lot of other people, including Tom Stalkup and Ray Lair and Christina Borges and others. We had unearthed a whole cache of CIA documents, you know, internal memos. And we knew that the FBI had been put on the job on day one. That was illegal because it was the NTSB's bailiwick, but it was at least done publicly. No one knew about the CIA, but they were on the job on day one also. And their task was to discredit all the eyewitnesses.
Wait a minute. Say that again, Jack, because those of us who have any familiarity with the charter of the CIA know that it isn't supposed to have anything to do with domestic activities. It is supposed to be, you know, protecting us against foreign enemies, usually on foreign soil, right? So you're telling me that the CIA was intimately involved from right after the crash in trying to essentially suppress the information that these eyewitnesses were presenting?
Yes, and I'm telling you that with 100% confidence. I mean, it's not a speculation. I have the documents, and we know it culminates.
Could you just say what kind of documents, Jack? Because, I mean, the 302s I get.
These are internal memoranda.
Within the CIA?
Yes, right. And I can name names. I can tell you who headed up, a guy named Randy Tauss. Randy, if you're listening, we know, you know who you are, of course.
We're going to talk more about Randy in a moment. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Jack Cashel and right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Dr. Jack Cashel. He is an author. He has been a dogged investigative reporter. And he has uncovered in an important book about TWA 800 a truth that is relevant, I think, not simply to what happened back in 1996 and thereafter concerning an aircraft apparently taken out by a Navy missile, though that conflicts with the official line. You can read about it in his book, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and the conspiracy. And Jack, you were just starting to talk a bit about the conspiracy when we had to take a short break. Pick up the narrative, please.
Right. As I was explaining just before the break, Frank, is that from day one, both the FBI and the CIA deeply involved themselves in the investigation, both illegally. Now, the FBI did it publicly, but there was no less illegal for doing that. The CIA did it entirely cryptically. So the media totally missed the CIA involvement. As I mentioned before the break, Randy Tausch headed up the CIA. He was a CIA analyst who headed up their end of it. And Jim Kallstrom headed up the FBI's end of the investigation. Of the two agencies, the CIA was clearly the one pulling the strings. And they had to have been authorized by the White House on day one. Otherwise, they would never have gotten involved. And this is, of course, a real election year for the Clintons, and most corrupt campaign in American political history, 95-96.
Yeah, and that's saying something. but it was the Clintons.
Yeah,
it's after
a lot of competition.
All. Yeah.
But so what happens? This culminated in November, finally, of 97, when the CIA goes public. The FBI invites them to show the video they had created of what the 250 eyewitnesses who thought they saw a missile striking an airplane actually saw. And they created this fantastic animation in which the plane, which is flying at about 13.7 thousand feet, it's a 747, thanks to a fuel tank explosion, the nose of it blows off, the plane turns upright, the plane shoots another 3,500 feet into space vertically almost, and confuses the bystanders into thinking that they saw a missile. The FBI showed this one time when they were closing their investigation in November 1997, 16 months after the incident, and that was that. Then they buried that video, and they ended the investigation, and they never interviewed or allowed to be interviewed or allowed to be seen any of the 250 eyewitnesses to a missile strike, 96 of whom, according to the NTSB's own numbers, followed the object from the horizon all the way up to the plane. And they told the same story in striking detail that would lead any dispassionate observer to believe that they actually saw a missile strike or missiles, and probably more than one, likely two or three.
But I assume, Jack Cashel, that you have consulted with aeronautical engineers and presumably people who've been in the airline business and maybe even manufacturers of them. Is there any basis to believe that an airplane, especially an airplane that was bombed, would follow the kind of bizarre flight path that you've just described that this movie tried to present as the alternative hypothesis?
No, in fact, you know, and I'm not an aviator, and there are a lot of people involved who know a whole lot more about airplanes than I do. They were, to a person, horrified by the scenario. You know, they said, this is impossible. A noseless airplane doesn't shoot up 4,000 feet. What it does is what actually happens, as they describe it, is that the weight of the plane shifts to the tail. You know, it may tilt into an upright position because the weight, like on a seesaw, you know. And then it just
starts losing lift in a real quick fashion.
Right, that's exactly right. And that's what all the witnesses said,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It said it tilted upright, then it fell right out of the sky, including other pilots who saw it, you know.
Right.
Now, and this, Jack, all of this information was buried.
Let me ask one obvious question, and that is there a Navy vessel in the area at the time of this incident and capable of launching a missile that would have done something like this to a civilian airliner? And if so, has anybody associated with that vessel been asked what happened aboard the ship?
Well, that's an excellent question. And, you know, as I was saying earlier, Frank, once I realized that it was extremely possible that this plane was shot down, you know, I was, in terms of confirmation bias, I was hoping it would be a terrorist, because I didn't like to think that our Navy could accidentally shoot down an airplane. But in fact, the evidence overwhelmingly supports that thesis. There's an accidental shoot down of the plane. Here's the smoking gun. The thing that no one can deny hovering right above Flight 800 when it went down was a Navy P-3 Orion, which is used as the center, the transmission center in these cooperative engagement capability exercises, where the combatants, that is the various ships and subs in the exercise, relay information through the P-3. And the P-3 was right there. I mean, literally right above TW-800 when it went down. We know there are multiple ships and subs in the area doing an exercise. The Navy denied it. The authorities refused to let any serious investigation into the Navy proceed. And basically, the New York Times, which owned the story, refused to even concede the possibility that the Navy was involved. And when, if you recall, when Pierre Salinger went forward with that theory in November of 96, they ruined him. They destroyed him. So I've talked to several people with information who got that message. They said, listen, if they could destroy someone like Pierre Salinger, JFK's press secretary, former U.S. senator, Lord knows what they could do to me.
Yeah.
You know?
So we turn next to some other supporting actors in this drama, because it turns out that while the case was essentially sealed, I guess you'd say, covered up, the 9/11 attack prompted a new set of, well, exposure opportunities for this information. Give us, again, the timeline, the narrative in that part of the tale.
Sure. In a sense, the relationship between the 1996 crash of the 800 and obviously 2001 destruction of the Flight 800 is that for the next 5 years after the crash, official Washington shied away about talking about aviation terror, especially about the possibility of using an airplane as a bomb to attack, a major population center. I'm convinced that they were doing this exercise in what should be a crowded airspace around New York, because if you're going to stop a plane attacking, New York, you have to do your exercises in the same kind of environment that, you're going to be able to, be useful in. The woman overseeing, this is where it gets really devious. The woman who oversaw the FBI investigation was a deputy attorney general named Jamie Gorelick. And it had to be a difficult job. Jan Arino, her boss, was a figurehead, and they just ignored her in the Clinton White House. Jamie Gorelick was a player. A year earlier, before the crash, Jamie Gorelick had authored the
Jamie Gorelick was their guy, in a manner of speaking,
yes.
In the White House, and Jan Arino, not necessarily so, right?
Right. The year before the attack on Flight 800, Gorelick authored the notorious Wall Memo that prevented the intelligence gatherers at the CIA from cooperating with the prosecutors at the FBI. And yet, a year later, it was Jamie Gorelick who oversaw the cooperation between the CIA and the FBI on the Flight 800 investigation.
And there's no question in your mind that she was central to this, let's call it what it is, a cover-up.
No, no question at all, because here's what happens. In May 1997, by this time the affair, Clinton's been reelected and the affair has been pretty much put to bed, she gets the most plum job in all of Washington, a job for which she has no relevant experience. She gets to be the vice chairman of Fannie Mae. As the New York Times would report, over the next 6 years, she made $25 million. Meanwhile, Fannie Mae was pulling the nation down into a total, meltdown economically. Then, patriot that she is, she steps down from that and becomes one of the five Democrats on the 9/11 commission. I mean, this is outrageous. And in that, and what she does, it wasn't until the end of the hearing that John Ashcroft, then the attorney general, reveals that Jamie Gorelick was the one who wrote the Wall Memo, the one who allowed 9/11 to happen, by shutting down the communication between intelligence and prosecution. And she had sat on that.
This would qualify as a conflict of interest, I would suggest,
totally.
in most cases.
She should have been the one who's being investigated.
Indeed. Yeah, contributing. And not least because, as you say, in the breach of this episode, this you know, wall precept, you actually had her manipulating the relationship between the FBI and CIA. This is such riveting stuff, Jack Cashel, and I, you know, the mind kind of reels at the implications of it, but we're going to pause and we're going to come back and start teasing out the implications of this kind of insidious, really betrayal of the public trust for both the aftermath of that episode, 9/11, and our own time. That and more with Jack Cashel right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined for this full hour by Dr. Jack Cashel. He is the author of at least seven extraordinarily important works of nonfiction, including the one we are speaking of today, as we remember, among other things, the first anniversary of a terrible attack on Americans in Las Vegas. We're calling to mind something that happened in 1996 to an aircraft that was designated TW-800. That is the title of his book, TW-800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. And Jack, we were obliged to pause, which is always crazy making, but this story is so riveting, and I want you to just pick it up, if you would, by introducing us to several of the other characters in this cast. We've talked a bit about, of course, Jamie Gorelick at the Justice Department, at least by inference. We've talked about what was going on in the White House as President Clinton's reelection was top of mind for folks there. But tell us about this this FBI agent who is kind of the hero of the piece.
Yeah, and this is interesting because, as I mentioned before, I get asked the question, well, you're telling me that hundreds and thousands of people were involved in this conspiracy? No. There's a half a dozen people who knew what happened that night, 10, 20 max. One guy who was involved, and it's curious because he was involved, he blew the whistle on 9/11 and on Flight 800. I did not know his name when I wrote the book, TWA Flight 800. But I knew this, is that there was one FBI agent who refused to roll over to the CIA. When the CIA presented all these bogus theories about what these people were seeing, and they were busily discrediting all 250 eyewitnesses to a missile strike, this FBI agent, who was relatively youthful, but he was a pilot for the U.S. Navy before he joined the FBI. He went through the Naval Academy, said no. And I found out his name after the book. His name's Steve Bongard. He's out now, and he does not want to go too public because he's got a young family. Has a new job after the FBI. But he also, in the run-up to 9/11, Lawrence Wright wrote about Bongard because he was one guy saying, Lawrence Wright wrote The Looming Tower, famous, you know, good, high-profile author. Bongard was saying, this wall memorandum, the Jamie Gorelick's notorious wall memorandum, was killing us. They were on the trail of at least one of the eventual 19 hijackers, and they weren't allowed to pursue it because of the discommunication between intelligence and prosecution. And Bongard was furious afterwards. I mean, because he said, and he alone, several of the people who testified to the 9/11 Commission, including the CIA director, George Tenet, and John Ashcroft, the U.S. Attorney General, Tenet's a Democrat, said the wall memo was the single one reason we were not able to prevent this from happening. And the author of that memo, Jamie Gorelick, was sitting quietly on that panel, one of five Democrats, and up until Ashcroft blew the whistle on her, no one even knew she was responsible. She should have been being interrogated.
There are two other individuals that I want to make sure we talk a little bit about, at least, Jack, whose role in all of this was really important. Walk us through those.
Yeah, one is Sandy Berger, who was the in 1996 was the deputy national security advisor. Tony Lake was the national security advisor, but Berger was the political guy. The Clintons put their number two person, they put their political operative under each of the, because their guys couldn't really get confirmed otherwise. So In 2004, Clinton assigns, between 2002 and 2004, Clinton assigns him the task, which he wasn't really thrilled about, of going into the National Archives, looking through the documents and destroying those documents that they could not afford to be seen.
Now, wait a minute. Let me just make sure I got this right. You're telling me that you have evidence the former president of the United States, Bill Clinton, directed Sandy Berger to destroy evidence in the National Archives? I'd always been told that this was something that Sandy had done on his own, self-defense, presumably. But there's actually evidence that Bill did it?
I have evidence that Bill directed Sandy Berger to go into the National Archives. I cannot prove that he said, yeah, he could destroy this information. But here's what Berger did. He jeopardized not only his reputation and his career, but his very freedom by doing this. What he was doing was conspicuously illegal. I think he expected to get away with it, but there's another hero in this story, and that's Paul Brackfield, who is the Inspector General for the Archives. And they apprehended, they spied Berger doing this on three occasions. He would take documents, stick it in his pants or his shorts or whatever, and then take it out. On one occasion, he took it out, he hid it under a construction site. This is highly classified, top secret, national document. He hides it in a construction site. At the end of the day, takes it home and shreds it by his own admission. Three times he did this, at least. And they can't be sure they weren't original documents. There's no way of knowing whether these documents were original or not, which means there were the unique copies. I'm convinced that...
Well, the question is, if there are no other copies of them, that would be a clue. But I guess they're not certain which documents he took. Is that the point?
And here's the thing, is Brackfield kept going to the Justice Department. This is the Bush Justice Department, which was being run fully by Democrats, by the way, just as it is now, is but run by the deep state operatives who've been there from the previous administration. And he said to them, you've got to tell the 9/11 Commission what Berger did before he testifies. On at least three occasions, he went to them and demanded that they tell the commissioners. And the Justice Department refused to tell the 9/11 commissioners that the man who was going to testify before them had already been caught, stealing and shredding top secret documents.
Yeah. One of whom, lest we forget, was Jamie Gorelick, who herself had been working with Sandy Berger in this cover-up. The mind, it just is exploding at what you're laying out here, especially in light of, again, some of the events that have unfolded besides this one that we'll talk about in a moment. But last but not least, I did want to just ask you to say a word about another actual old friend of mine, a man I've admired for a long time, former Congressman Curt Weldon. What role did he play in all of this, and what happened to him as a result?
Well, that's a good question, because in the summer of 2006, I and the number one CIA eyewitness to the crash, around whom they based their animation, went to Washington to visit Curt. And we were expecting to get 15 minutes, a pat on the head, and sent off. But instead, we spent 2 hours in his office with him and his chief of staff, going over all our information. He was uniquely interested in getting to the bottom of the deep state shenanigans that were, that had paralyzing Washington. And for which, what the FBI did, and I'm sure they did it at the direction of, I don't know, not at the Bush White House. Bush would not have authorized this, but someone did. They went in like 3 days before the election. And he was, he'd been a 10-term congressman. He was running against Joseph Sestak, who was a big friend of, whose campaign manager was Sandy Berger.
Wow. A Navy admiral, as I recall.
Yeah, right. Who had been thrown out for poor command performance, presence. They go into his office, publicly raid his daughter's office, and charging, for allegedly looking for conspiracy with Russia, right? In the meantime,
that playbook.
When the agents are on the job, a whole series of Democratic protesters are there with signs, matching signs, reading "caught red-handed," right? So. Sestak, Weldon went from, being ahead of the polls to being down, and Sestak beats him. That's how dirty they were playing even then. And By the way, I should mention one more thing about Sandy Berger, whose Weldon was on Sandy Berger's tail, which is why this happened.
Of course. It's no accident, comrade, as they say.
The Justice Department recommended, after he got caught at three occasions stealing and shredding top-secret documents, a $10,000 fine and a three-year suspension of his top security clearance, just in time to get back in time for the 2008 election.
Back in the game. Well, again, just to summarize, what you have laid bare, Jack Cashel, in your book TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy, as well as, you know, your writings and speaking on this matter, is a staggering story of the American government working to conceal from the American people information that contributed to the murder, unintentional and certainly accidental, but nonetheless the murder of a couple hundred of us. And in the process,
not to mention the 3,000 that came in 2001.
You know? Well, and perhaps contributing to that too as well, indeed. But what I guess I just wanted to say in the run up to our last break before we regroup with you is, this would seem unbelievable, I think, to most Americans. And yet what we've now been treated to, if I can use that expression, particularly in connection with the Hillary Clinton investigation by the FBI at the hands of people like James Comey and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and James Baker and John Brennan and so on, really makes it clear that this kind of deep statery, or some might call it counter state activity, is not unfortunately unique to this particular instance of TWA 800. In fact, when we come back, I want to walk through with you a couple more to get your thoughts on them as well. Jack Cashel is with us for the remainder of this hour. Stay tuned because we've got some fantastically important stuff to talk about right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily important conversation with Dr. Jack Cashel, a man who has written again and again and again on matters of great importance to our country, including deconstructing Obama and hoodwinked and Ron Brown's body, but also, as we've been discussing to this point in the show, TW8 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. And Jack, I just wanted to widen the lens a little bit here. I mentioned as we were wrapping up the last block that Hillary Clinton's kid glove treatment, shall we say, at the hands of the FBI and the Department of Justice, when she should have been prosecuted, it seems to me, for serial criminal misconduct, including the compromise of classified information on a massive basis, some of which may have contributed, we're told, to the rolling up of a spy network the United States government had labored to build in communist China, and the loss of a number of agents. But I wanted to go to another episode in which it seems that the FBI was highly politicized, once again, by the Clintons. And that is in the 1995 attack on the Murrow Federal Building in Oklahoma City. Tell us a little bit about what you've learned from a woman I've known a little bit, Jaina Davis, and others, on what actually happened there and what we were told.
Yeah, I've done a lot of independent research on that. And here's what we can say with confidence, because this, I mean, I will say the Washington Post reported, I believe it, because it doesn't support their future narratives. And that is that a couple days after the incident, Timothy McVeigh was being held on he was having a detention hearing, and whether they could detain him federally because they stopped him on a state, license plate charge. And the FBI agent testified that multiple eyewitnesses had seen McVeigh in the company of another fellow, around Oklahoma City that morning driving a truck. In total, there were 32 eyewitnesses to McVeigh and a short foreign-looking man, driving in that Ryder truck, cruising the attic place, including this one woman who lost her leg in the incident, the last thing she saw was them getting out of getting back into the truck and right in front of the building. And there are multiple eyewitnesses. This is not even in doubt. And yet that John Doe number two, the short, swarthy, foreign-looking guy, was made to disappear. Because what he did is that for Clinton, it would have been disastrous had this been Islamic terrorism. But a domestic terrorist, when you have white, right-wingers involved, is just perfect for him. He began his political comeback, he admits, in April 1995 in the rubble of Oklahoma City.
Fascinating. What I have been told is that Bill Clinton personally expressed the hope that there was no Middle Eastern connection to this attack. And I have the feeling that had something to do with the disappearing of a guy who not only is there reason to believe had a Middle Eastern connection, but that according to Jana Davis, this NBC News local reporter at the time, and her affidavits from these folks indicated was actually an Iraqi Republican Guard officer before he got into the business of blowing up the Murrah Center building. Interesting information that needs to be rigorously scrutinized, and another case, I think, where a cover-up that obscured this reality took place. That brings me to, of course, the Hillary Clinton caper, and we know a lot now, thanks to congressional investigations and judicial watches revelations. I'm so grateful to them, not only for reconnecting us, Jack Cashel, but also for the work that they've done over the years on trying to find out what Hillary Clinton did and thus far has gotten away with. But there, too, I think it's fair to say, there is deep rot, not throughout the FBI, to be sure, not affecting, I'd like to believe, at least the vast majority of people who work there, because God knows the country needs them to be doing their job, but among the leadership. Right. And so it kind of fits a pattern both with the Clintons and with the FBI leadership.
Yeah, it does. It's unfortunate. And you're right. I would say, when you look at Flight 800, where there are literally hundreds of FBI agents involved, I mean, 99% of them did exactly what they were told to do. They gathered up witness statements, blah, blah, blah. It's only a few handful who knew what was going on. But the FBI wasn't even in charge of that. It was really the CIA. The NTSB was just shunted aside. But and then we see it with Hillary Clinton. We see that same phenomenon, but even more aggressively and openly. It's harder to get away with stuff today in the age of the internet.
And unfortunately, you say it's harder to get away with it, but Hillary Clinton has gotten away with it so far. Let me turn to one last item before we run out of time, Jack Cashel, because I know this is a subject that you're somewhat familiar with, but we're all still largely, I believe, in the dark about what has been going on. But in the 40 years that I've been involved with national security policy, I have never seen anything remotely like the lack of information that has been made public in connection with the attack that took place a year ago in Las Vegas.
And the lack of media interest.
Well, the media interest is one story, where is the FBI report of what happened when 50 plus people were murdered and hundreds more were hurt? And we still don't have anything other than a very thin story, which I must say, based on people I know who've done some independent forensic analysis, does not stand up to scrutiny. By that I mean this idea that it was just one guy and he inexplicably decided to do this. I think there's a lot more to this. And what makes this so worrying is if it fits a pattern, and I'm not suggesting that the Trump administration is doing what the Clinton team has done serially now. I'm just saying that I think the FBI at the senior management level has seemingly fallen into its old ways when it comes to a story that a lot of people in Las Vegas did not want to see the light of day. Your thoughts?
You know, what's a likely pattern here, Frank, is that, and this may have happened in Oklahoma City as well, but it certainly happened in a case in Western Kansas where these three white nationalist type were threatening to blow up a Somali apartment complex. Also in Massachusetts, where the son of a Boston police captain was caught on the left and he was threatening to attack and blow up stuff, is that in every case, the FBI, in those two cases I know for sure because they've both gone to trial, is that the FBI was supplying these guys with weapons and leading them along, right, so they can entrap them in a crime, right? I think it's altogether possible. I would say this is the most likely scenario, rather than some deeper conspiracy. And the reason for the FBI's reticence is that they were involved with this guy, setting him up so they could nail him in the act or something, and it gets out of hand. You know, that may have happened in Oklahoma City as well. They do this. It's a dangerous game they play. I know they play it. I don't know they played it in Las Vegas, but it wouldn't shock me at all if they had. And it would give them all the reason in the world to keep quiet about it.
Well, that may be. It's not the fact pattern that I'm aware of, which indicates that there was, in fact, a second shooter. And that
that wouldn't shock me either.
The second shooter had connections to Antifa. And in addition, had, it seems, circumstantial evidence, but some ties as well to ISIS operatives who came in from Mexico. These are elements of the story that have not been reported, to be sure, but I believe warrant close scrutiny. We are hard out of time, I'm sorry to say, and obviously we could talk further about all of these issues, including the subject of your terrific book, TWA 800, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. Check it out, folks. Jack Cashel, again, thank you so much for your time today. Great work. Come back to us again if you would soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.